Welcome to the podcast of Grace Covenant Church, where we are transformed by God's grace, connected through relationships, and committed to service.
Good morning again, and happy Mother's Day once more. You know, we're talking about kind of working through a series of thinking things, and this time we're thinking it through in relationships. When we talk about relationships, in a lot of ways we're talking about the maturity or the nurturing of the soul. Soul in Greek is the word psyche. A person who studies the psyche, a person who studies the soul, is a psychologist. So if we're going to think it through when it comes to relationships and the health of our souls, especially in relationships, we're going to need a psychologist. So there were a lot to choose from all around the country. We'd bring anybody in for that. But let me tell you a story. Just anyone. No, what I meant was the best. Not anyone would do, but the best. And about 10 years ago, I was at a preaching conference. There's a national preaching conference every year in Boston. Gordon Conwell sponsors that. And in the section about how to connect with your audience and how to care for them, they had the guest speaker come in from the counseling department at Gordon Conwell. And the gentleman came out and was talking to the gang about how to relate to the well-being of people's hearts. And he said, listen, I'll tell you, the fast way of getting to this is if everyone here would buy this book and read it. And he held it up, and it was Lies We Believe by Dr. Chris Thurman. And I thought, the golfer? He wrote a book? Oh, my. I came home and went, hey, you do other things besides loiter at golf courses. Good for you. Yeah. Good for you. So Chris isn't here because he's one of our favorite Sunday school teachers. What class do you teach the adult community?
Young Marrieds.
Young Marrieds, okay. Yeah. He's a favorite there, and he's made his way through a lot of our adult communities, even our youth ministry. But he's here because he understands relationships. He's spent most of his career on talking about that. Why don't you introduce yourself to us and tell us about your family and your profession, that sort of thing.
Well, thank you for the introduction. I appreciate that. Grew up an Air Force brat, so home was all around the country growing up. Went off to, became a believer when I was 11, and felt pretty early on, when I was a freshman in high school, God calling me into counseling. Just always had an interest in people's emotional well-being and how they were doing, and just always had kind of a heart for hurting people. Went off to UT in 71 to study psychology, proceeded to take intro psych and make a D. So I thought, this is not starting well. Made a D in my intro psych class. So did undergrad there, came back and did my PhD at UT also. Met Holly at UT, and if anybody knows Holly, they know. Just
that was during a dark page part of her life, wasn't it?
So I talked her into marrying me, yeah. And she's just awesome. And got my PhD in 81, went off to North Texas to teach and counsel at the University of North Texas. Went on to work in the Dallas area for a number of years, and then came back to Austin in 91 to basically do private practice and to raise the kids. Got three awesome kids, a son who's a lawyer, a daughter who's working on her PhD in psychology, and a youngest who broke my heart by going off to A&M. So I will never forgive her.
That was Holly's fault.
That was, she went over to the dark side. So,
Well, I can't imagine what your life is like and what business is for you. So help us understand that.
Well, I thought I'd show everybody a clip to drive home what my day-to-day professional life is like. So let's
show
that.
Day in the life of Chris Thurman.
Yeah.
Are you married?
I'm divorced.
Would you like to talk about that?
There are two types of people in this world. Those who like Neil Diamond and those who don't. My ex-wife loves him.
I see. So what you're saying is that even though you are an almost paralyzed, multiphobic personality and is in a constant state of panic. Your wife did not leave you. You left her because she liked Neil Diamond.
Now, you're saying that maybe I didn't leave her because she likes Neil Diamond, but maybe she left me?
Yes.
Ow. 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 Dr. Marvin, you can help me. For the first time in my life, I feel like there's hope. I feel like I can be somebody.
So that's what it's like in my office every day is, you know, just tremendous insights and people doing radical 180s. So,
now, are you Bill Murray in that skit? Or when you say your office, which, okay.
Here's, funny.
Okay. All right, here's one of the... some observations that I've seen over the years. It's very interesting, and that is that there are some people that are able to have relationships, and deep ones, rather easily. And then there's other ones that require a lot more work. There's something in them that prevents them from doing that. That's one observation. Some are easy, some have difficulty. The other thing that is unfortunate is I have found that there's a considerable number of people with a vast amount of Bible knowledge that fall into the category of not being able to have great, deep relationships. Some of the best Sunday school teachers I've sat under, they don't know how to relate. I've seen pastors that went to seminary, and they can't go deep. I've seen seminary professors, some of the worst relational skills I've ever seen were with seminary professors. So while Bible knowledge is necessary to have deep understanding, forgiveness, and courage, that sort of thing, there's not a direct connection there. In other words, you have to do... Why is it? I guess I'm having a hard time putting words to it. Why is it that people that can know the Bible so well but be so clumsy and mean-spirited or unable to forgive? What? And have you seen that? Have you seen that, mm-hmm. First of all, and is there some...
Yeah, I've seen that too, it concerns me that that's the case, that as believers, we can allow Satan to blind us to the fact that it's primarily about relationship.
Right.
I mean, you and I would be the last to not encourage people into the Word, but sometimes we miss the main thing, which is God created us for relationship with Him and with one another, and... You know, sometimes people come to Christ and they really earnestly study the Word of God, but they don't necessarily let God have their way with them about love one another.
Right.
And be close to one another and lift up one another and encourage one another. So it's rather tragic that sometimes in Christianity we have not pulled off the level of relationship health that we need.
So, I mean, I would say... because of some passages in a writing called 1 John, that if a person thinks they have a very deep relationship with God, but cannot, because they choose not, to have deep relationships with other people, they're deluding themselves. In other words, the relationship with God that they're having is artificial. It's not really God. It's a figure in their head because they can't relate to their fellow man. How could they relate to God? Would you agree with that?
Yes, and it's a little bit, you know, tough to go after people like that without sounding like you're being condemning. But I do think we are deluding ourselves if we think we have a close relationship with the Lord, but we are not loving His image bearers.
Right, right. If we can't hear a hard word from a fellow man, we're probably not going to hear a hard word from God that's out there.
Right.
We'll reject Him like we did others. Okay, listen, here's what we're going to do today. Chris and I have met several times, and Chris came and said, look, there are at least 8 pillars to understanding how to have deep relationships when you think these things through with our fellow man and with God. There were 8 essentials to do that, and we couldn't do that today. We wouldn't have time. But we were able to get 4 that were absolutely elemental and a place to build. And to understand these four, we have notes provided for you. And what we'd like to do is we'd like to just go through, quickly explain each one of those four measures of maturity, and then describe what they are, then look where the Bible is saying, look, these passages are relationally centered passages in the book. These are words from God on how to relate to one another and how to relate to God. So let's look at those passages in that context. And then Chris has brought a number of clips from an award-winning film called The King's Speech to help us illustrate what that looks like in a contemporary relationship. It's a fabulous movie. If nothing else, it's about the evolution of a deep relationship and how to think that through in the four areas that we're going to look at, but just in general. And then we're going to ask each person to look at their notes and say, you know what, how am I scoring on this? How do I do in one of these four areas? And what I'd really like is for everyone here to be able to walk out of the auditorium and say, okay, of the four areas, and I'm looking at the scores, this is what I need to work on for the next 6 months or so. This measure of deepness, of depth, this is what I want to spend time on. This is what I'm going to pray for. This is what I'm going to ask other people to bring into my life, okay? So with that in mind, the first one we're going to look at together is bonding itself, all right? Bonding. The definition of bonding is the willingness to meet relational needs of others. What does that mean, Chris?
Well, we want to communicate on that God, when he makes people, he makes them needy. God does not make people self-sufficient. So in a relational context, we're trying to drive home the idea that bonding between people, intimacy, closeness, connection, whatever synonym you use, is tied to knowing what the relational needs of a person are and being selfless enough to meet those in that person.
Right.
And so, if everybody's doing that, then we're going to end up with a healthy bond between us, whether it's husband and wife or parent to child or friend to friend.
And here's some up on the screens. Some of the ones, why don't you maybe draw attention to some of those that are God-designed,
right,
that we're here on this planet to help each other meet these needs.
Right, yeah. These are a list of what I think our relational intimacy needs are. Appreciation would be an example. You know, we all have a need for appreciation to be expressed to us about things that we do. With it being Mother's Day, I would just say along those lines to all you moms, I mean, gratitude for all the sacrificial loving and giving that you've done with your children. So appreciation is a valid relational need. Encouragement, which means to urge someone forward, is a relationship need that we all bring into our relationships. Support is more acts of service, a need for people's help. But again, we're just trying to drive home the idea that bonding has to occur in the context of meeting these needs in one another.
Right. Seeing them and giving them. There's right. Jesus's quote there that... that instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be a servant. Whoever wants to be first must be your slave, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life for the ransom of many. He came as an example of bonding in serving other people. I think Jesus does a wonderful job of modeling. Of course, he would be the perfect model as he's the second Adam, right? But one of the ways that he models it, not because this is a two-way street, a lot of people are givers, but they won't receive. I think it's interesting that when Jesus was desperate and very needy, he asked his followers, his disciples, to pray with him. I'm going to need some prayer. I need you guys to help pray. Didn't work out so good for him. His disciples were a little bit sleepy. But I like the fact that Jesus was looking for his disciples to help in those relational needs as well.
Yeah, I think it's staggering. You have God in human form,
right,
and here he is serving us. I mean, that
right.
Just, you can't wrap your mind around God serving his own creation.
Right.
But then him putting his needs in play, the vulnerability of that, the humanness of that.
Right. Opens himself up, and some people took advantage of it, some people did not. John was the one who loved him, right? Okay, we have a clip here from King's Speech. It's about bonding. It's probably the first part of it.
Right.
And it's a little bit clunky, isn't it?
Yeah, the movie, for those of you who haven't seen it, it's about Prince Albert back around World War II time period having a speech impediment. He was a stammerer. And he seeks out various kinds of help and ends up in the office of Colin Firth is the prince. Jeffrey Rush is the speech therapist. And this is the opening session between the two of them where Jeffrey Rush, as the speech therapist, is trying to create a bond with him. He's trying to get connected up with him so that he can do what he as a therapist does. So that's what this scene is about.
Well, the foundation of his counseling model is to befriend his client so that he could encourage him. And so this is his initial attempt at doing that with a prince.
Well, I believe when speaking with the prince, one waits for the prince to choose the topic.
Waiting for me to commence a conversation, one can wait rather a long wait.
Do you know any jokes?
Timing isn't my strong suit.
Cup of tea?
No, thank you.
I think I'll have one.
Aren't you going to start treating me, Dr. Loeb?
Only if you're interested in being treated. Please. Call me Lionel.
Prefer doctor.
I prefer Lionel. What'll I call you?
Your Royal Highness. Then sir, after that.
It's a little bit formal for here. I prefer names.
Prince Albert, Frederick, Arthur, George.
How about Bertie?
Only my family uses that.
Perfect. In here, it's better if we're equals.
If we were equals, I wouldn't be here.
Well, please don't do that.
I'm sorry?
I believe sucking smoke into your lungs will kill you.
My physicians say it relaxes the throat.
Well, they're idiots.
They've all been knighted.
Makes it official, then. My castle, my rules. Thank you.
So, in the initial introduction of a friendship, we can see that maybe because of the king's background, it's keeping him from being able to engage in any kind of a relationship.
Yeah, you know from watching the movie, he did not have a relationship with his father that was very good, with his older brother who was king or became king. And here, again, Jeffrey Rush is trying to get a relationship going with him from which he can be therapeutic, that he can help this guy overcome his problem.
Right. So on your scoring yourselves, it's, you know, the scale is from on the far left of one. Are you a taker in relationships or are you a giver? Are you one that kind of initiates things or are you one that just receives and that's all? Okay. Why don't you score yourself on that and then think about that in the future. And the next one is on beliefs. We have this icon up for beliefs because that's a filter for water. The most important thing for your body that you intake is the water. The purer the water, the better it is for your body. So it is with your mind. You need to filter what goes into your mind. And the definition of beliefs is committed to believing and living out truth. It's the ability to filter what is a lie and what is truthful, and then believing it and then living it out. If only someone had written a book, The Lies We Believe, then we could pinpoint those very lives, those lies that we live.
Yes, we could.
That's a great book.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's a good book to read. So how does that play itself out in the context of being able to have relationships, though?
Well, you cannot have a healthy bond with anyone if you are being, if you filter situations through faulty thinking. So the idea is, and the reason why the Bible camps out so much on the renewal of your mind is what you tell yourself, what you believe, your attitudes, your expectations, those mental tapes that play in your head, make or break whether or not you can successfully bond with somebody else. So that's why another key to spiritual maturity and psychological health is, are you thinking truth? Are you really believing truth? Are you filtering what happens between you and another human being through the right tapes or the wrong tapes?
Right. Here's a great Bible verse that lists those things that are true. Why don't you read that for us?
Finally, brothers, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about such things.
Mm-hmm. A lot of times when people come to me and they've been hurt by someone else, the words that they've spoken, whether it's a friend or a lover or a parent or whatever it might be, usually the first question I ask is it true? Did what they say to you, is that true? Because if it's not true, again, we run that through the filter, then you need not contemplate it. If it is true, or has truth to it, then let's talk and negotiate on what to do about that. But if we don't have filters up, just because someone knows you or is close to you, doesn't mean you have to listen to everything they say. You have to have some sort of grid to run it through, right?
Absolutely. And you know, all of us, I don't care what name you, what title you have before your name, or if you're a senior pastor or anybody, you've got tapes running the show that right. are not doing you right. They're not going to help you relate healthily to other people. So we all have need for renewal of our mind, taking thoughts captive, whatever is true, think on these things.
Right. And so in the clip we're about to see, we're going to see that the prince is confronted with truth by now a growing friendship.
Yes, by this clip, they have worked with each other for a while. The relationship is beginning to form, still pretty fragile. You'll see from the clip that the relationship's not solid yet. And Jeffrey Rush, as the therapist, is trying to bring some truth to bear on Colin Firth as the prince. And boy, it goes south on him pretty quickly.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
What's the matter? Why are you so upset?
Logue, you have no idea. My brother is infatuated with a woman who's been married twice. She's asking for a divorce and he's determined to marry her. Mrs. Wallace Simpson of Baltimore.
That's not right. Queen Wallace of Baltimore.
Unthinkable.
Can he do it?
Absolutely not. But he's going to anyway. All hell's broken loose.
Can't they just carry on privately?
If only they would.
Where does this leave you?
I know my place. I would do anything in my power to keep my brother on the throne.
Is it that serious? Your place may well be on the throne.
I'm not an alternative to my brother.
You can outshine David.
Don't take liberties! That's bordering on treason.
I'm just saying you could be king. You could do it.
That is treason.
I'm trying to get you to realize you needn't be governed by fear.
I've had enough of this.
What are you so afraid of?
Your poisonous words!
Why did you come to me? You're not some middle-class banker who wants elocution lessons so you can chit-chat.
Oh, don't attempt to instruct me on my duties. I am the son of a king. The brother of a king. You're the disappointing son of a brewer. Jumped up jackaroo from the outback. You're nobody. These sessions are over.
All right. I mean, just the choreography of that scene, you see that he's confronted with truth, that he could be who God made him to be, and that's king. And what happens is what happens in a lot of relationships. You attack the man. You attack the messenger of that truth instead of having to live with it. And then, again, the scene setting is beautiful in that he finds himself distancing himself from his friendship and then returns to smoking another truth that this man gave him that he didn't want to hear. And so it's hanging on the edge here, isn't it?
Well, if we are in the process of change, then truth has to be part of that. And sometimes our reaction to truth is that reaction, right? I mean, sometimes if you're not in the place to hear it, you're going to get angry, you're going to get defensive, and you're going to counterattack the person trying to speak truth to you.
Right.
So it's a pretty tenuous thing to, you know, counsel and to try to play that role of the messenger of what you hope is God's truth to that person. And sometimes you get your head handed to you by a client.
Let's see how do you score yourself on that? You believe and practice lies, believe and practice truth. Can you give truth? Can you receive truth? The practicing of truth. Okay? So we've had bonding, we have beliefs. Our next one is on brokenness. And there's a beautiful picture of one of the many paintings of the prodigal son. This is the return of the younger son to his father. We define brokenness as being humble by practicing godly sorrow and forgiveness. Notice there's two parts of there. There's godly sorrow and forgiveness. Godly sorrow is defined, it's a kind of a strange phrase, but it's found in the Bible, and that's why we're using it. It says in 2 Corinthians, godly sorrow brings repentance that leads to salvation and leaves no regret. But worldly sorrow brings death. So let me explain why Paul is using those two phrases in contrast to one another. The first one over here, godly sorrow, that is the thing that causes grace to transform, another one of our pillars of belief here at Grace. But you have to have godly sorrow first. And that means you don't regret the cost of your decision, you regret the decision. When you have godly sorrow, what weighs heavy on your heart is that you've injured a fellow man, and you've also injured the holiness of God. And that hurts you. And you're happy to pay whatever it takes to restore that. Worldly sorrow is when you regret getting caught. When you are heavy about the consequences of your choices. Oh, I don't want to be embarrassed that people find out about this. I don't want to have to go to jail or pay the fine or do whatever. And you're throwing tantrums about the cost to you. Godly sorrow over here is usually, here's how you know which one is which. Godly sorrow is usually looking forward to paying to make things right. Because that's the easy part. I want to restore my relationship with God. I want to restore my relationship with you. And I want to pay back what it takes. That's godly sorrow. It leads to life because that's what's required for grace to transform. This person over here will say things like, well, gosh, I said I was sorry. Like, that's all I have to pay to this. The other part of it is forgiveness, the ability to give forgiveness. And there's that passage in Colossians. Bear with each other and forgive whatever grievances you may have against one another. Forgive as the Lord forgave you. So you need to be forgiven, but you also need to give forgiveness. We see this a lot in the life of Jesus Christ. But certainly, I mean, the reason we have the prodigal son there is because that's the story. Why don't you tell us how we spoke a lot about the prodigal son being a major theme in this brokenness.
Well, I think in using the word brokenness, we're really trying to say another marker of spiritual maturity and psychological health is humility.
Right.
Okay? Humble enough that when you have hurt somebody, you have genuine sorrow. So that would be a marker that you're a fairly healthy person, that you can have genuine sorrow when you've messed up. And humble enough that you can offer forgiveness to people who've hurt you. Because the other side of that coin is, if you let your ego get in the way, you're not going to have godly sorrow about what you've done, and you're going to be unforgiving toward people who have wounded you. So another key aspect of self-examination is, am I humble enough to have both?
Right.
a genuine sorrow when I mess up, a genuine forgiveness of wiping the slate clean when someone messes up against me.
The younger son, when he comes to his senses, does not return to his father expecting to be a son again. He just wants to be an employee. See, he doesn't have any expectations that are outside of what should be. And the father is so humbled, he is so humble representing God himself, that he receives that son and restores him by paying what it costs. He wears that. He gives that forgiveness. So what's happening in the king's speech where forgiveness is given and received?
Well, after they've had that horrific collision with each other in the park, this scene is where Colin Firth comes back to see Jeffrey Rush, and he's now king, and he apologizes, and Jeffrey Rush apologizes to him. So they repair via genuine sorrow and the seeking of forgiveness. They repair their relationship with each other.
Waiting for King to apologize, one can wait rather a long wait.
I'm afraid we're slightly late.
This is home. Myrtle's at bridge. I made sure the boys were out.
It's lovely. Absolutely lovely. Oh, may I sit down?
Yes, of course. Would you like some tea, ma'am?
Yes, I'll help myself. Now off you go. Or must I knock your heads together?
Here's your shilling. I understand what you were trying to say, Lloyd. I went about it the wrong way. I'm sorry. So, here I am. Is the nation ready for 2 minutes of radio silence? Every stammerer always fears going back to square one. I don't let that happen. If I fail in my duty, David could come back. I've seen the placards. God save our king. Don't mean me. Every monarch in history has succeeded someone who was dead, or just about to be. My predecessor is not only alive, but very much so. Couldn't even give them a Christmas speech. Like your dad used to do. Precisely. He's not here anymore. Yes, he is. It's on that shilling I gave you. Easy enough to give away. You don't have to carry him around in your pocket. Or your brother. You don't need to be afraid of the things you were afraid of when you were 5. You're very much your own man, Bertie. Your face is next, mate.
If you have a deep relationship, I want you to see that scene is part of a deep relationship. You can't have deep friendships without having confessions and forgiveness. If you can get along for years without something like that happening, it's not a friendship, it's an acquaintance, which makes for fun building projects or maybe some sports or social engagements, but it's not a deep friendship. You have to be able to humble yourself with godly sorrow and present your apology, and you have to be able to receive an apology and give that, right?
It's not negotiable. I mean, there are ways God has wired relationships that you cannot violate, and if you cannot get to a genuine apology, your relationship is over.
What's great in this story, like all the other stories, is their friendship becomes far deeper as a result of the injury and scar, and now they've grown deeper because they're able to do this. So how do you score yourself on proud, unforgiving, unrepentant, or humble, repentant, and forgiving? How do you think you'd score there? Can you think of a story in your own mind with your mate or with a friend where you found yourself one who is able to be humbled or a person who's able to give forgiveness? Okay. The last thing that we have here is boldness. Great little picture, huh? If you can't base jump, you can't have relationships.
That is true.
Here's what boldness means. It's the willingness to face problems head on. It's the willingness to face problems head on. You're going to have problems. You're going to have problems with your relationships. You have to be able to stand those down. A great proverb that puts it rather succinctly. Why don't you take that?
The wicked man flees, though no one pursues, but the righteous are as bold as a lion.
Right. I mean, Jesus is, if nothing, he's an example of this, isn't he? He was courageous in who he associated with. He associated with people that were socially cancerous, tax collectors and prostitutes, those sorts of people that were moral outcasts, but not to him. And then the people he was able to stand up to were the religious self-righteous. Not all the religious, they were humble men there too, and women, but the self-righteous ones. He stared Pilate in the face. He was able to face the cross. In the battle of the Garden of Gethsemane, he won that because he was courageous to do the will of the Father. And that's what we have to be able to have great relationships.
We have to be willing to go up to Goliath, right? Mm-hmm. We have to stare down problems. If you run from problems, they get worse. It's another spiritual law you can't violate. Mm-hmm. So if you run from problems in your relationship, the relationship has to become worse. So courage, boldness, whatever you want to call it, Right. It's got to be in play for things to go well.
And this story in the King's Speech is a story of a friend encouraging, making his friend be courageous. What's the next clip about?
The prince has now become the king. He has found out that the therapist, Lionel, is not a doctor, is not credentialed. Not that Lionel ever told him he was. So they have this collision over that, and the king is now about to basically fire Lionel Logue as his therapist. But they have this classically wonderful scene about the king finding his own boldness, finding his own courage.
But the king's attacking him because he's thinking the credentials are what pushing him out. If the credentials don't exist, then he doesn't have to be out there on that limb after all.
That's right.
So there's a lot going on here.
Lock me in the tower.
I would, if I could.
On what charge?
Fraud. With war looming, you've saddled this nation with a voiceless king. You've destroyed the happiness of my family, all for the sake of ensnaring a star patient you couldn't possibly hope to assist. It'll be like mad King George III. It'll be mad King George the Stammerer, who let his people down so badly in their hour of need. What are you doing? Get up! You can't sit there! Get up!
Why not? It's a chair.
No, that is not a chair. That is St. Edward's chair.
People have carved their names on it.
Chair is the seat on which every king
is held
and queen...
It's held by a large rock.
That is the stone of Scone. You are trivializing
you
everything. Listen to me!
Listen to you? By what right?
By divine right, if you must. I am your king.
No, you're not. You told me so yourself. You said you didn't want it. Why should I waste my time listening
because
to you?
Because I have a right to be, and I have a voice!
Yes, you do. You have such perseverance, Bertie. You're the bravest man I know.
You know what good friends can do is they can see what God meant you to be while you're blinded to that, and they can encourage you to be that, right?
to help you be who God meant you to be, right, even if it means you go after each other to some degree like right. that.
If you look at the icon up there, you can see the first guy was actually pushed off by the second guy. He didn't go up to base jump. He was going up for the view. So how do you score yourself on this one? You run from problems or do you face them? Have you learned to negotiate? One of the beautiful parts of this movie, and one of the things that we want to make sure that you understand here, especially at Grace, is that we appreciate that people are quite clumsy at relationships. Because of their background, especially the contemporary culture that we were raised in, we don't know how to have good relationships. And so you have to struggle through, you have to be patient, but you have to be courageous. How do you score on that? Okay. Well, I want to know how the story ends. What help us understand where this thing eventually goes and the power of deep intimacy.
Well, because they actually went through the four non-negotiables, bonded with each other, worked on the faulty beliefs that were plaguing the king, both humbled themselves enough to stay in the relationship with each other, and boldly went after facing the problem, getting through it. They end up at the end of the movie with him about to give this speech to England during World War II coming online. So we've got the clip before he actually gives the speech where they have another moment that I think is real tender with each other, and then a very tender moment after the speech has been given where they talk to each other. So,
...40 seconds, sir.
Logue, however this turns out, I don't know how to thank you for what you've done.
Knighthood? Forget everything else and just say it to me. Say it to me as a friend. Your first wartime speech. Congratulations.
I expect I shall have to do a great deal more. Thank you, Logue. Well done, my friend.
Thank you, Your Majesty.
In the fullness of time, our freedom is rather frail. It's hinging, at least in this story, on a speech, a king's speech, and that speech is hinging on the depth of friendships. When we think it through, when we talk about relationships, we have to think about these four things. And knowing these four things, and maybe an additional four, can only go so far with us. And I'll bet you've probably said this in your practice, but Jesus said one of the most profound things when it comes to counseling, when he was speaking with someone who was at the pool of Bethesda, a pool that was known to heal people. And he'd been there quite some time, maybe most of his life, maybe his whole life, and he was giving excuses on why he was still there. And so Jesus asks him this question. He says, "Do you want to get better?" Now that is either the dumbest question any human has ever asked, or it is the most insightful question. Have you ever asked a client, "Do you want to get better?"
I have asked that question a few times, and it's the most insightful question that you can pose. There are a lot of times for all of us where we want the nice outcome, but we are not truly willing to do the work that it takes to get us there. So pushing somebody in a non-shaming way, "Do you really want this? And are you willing to do what it takes to have healthy relationships, vertically, horizontally, overcome problems that you may have?" We all stare that you know, eyeball to eyeball sometimes about truly wanting to get better or not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, at Grace Covenant Church, what we want you to do is, if you look at these four things and you say, gosh, I want to get better at these things, you truly do. We can't end the sermon by take this pill, kind of the Bill Murray, oh, I'm all better now. It takes some time. This church is structured around being transformed by God's grace, committed to service, and committed through relationships. And what we mean by that is we have so many opportunities for you to be mentored by people in many of our adult communities, our Sunday school classes, our midweek Bible studies, they're called life groups, in MOPS, in Celebrate Recovery, in the Stephen Ministry. It's all out there, but you have to do something. You have to want to get better and be willing to do that. You have to take the next step. It's one of the reasons Chris comes to Grace. He serves in one of our adult communities because he likes to see people's lives changed, because that's what we do here. So would you consider that? If you don't mark any of the things on your notes today, would you consider this? Would you consider jumping in a little deeper here at this church or another church that's committed to relationships that way as well? Chris, thank you, my friend.
My pleasure.
Thanks for helping us today.
My pleasure.
Let me close our time in prayer. We have a wonderful song to sing in an offertory. Dear Heavenly Father, we lift up our church to you that we could be a healing church, that we could be a church where people's understanding of having a relationship with their fellow man is just like having a relationship with you. And we can't say we have a great one with you if we can't have a great one with others. So God, would you cause us to desire more in relationships and be willing to pay the hard prices to have that? Conflict and resolution and more conflict and more resolution. Understanding, giving, not just taking. Help us be well, Lord, and help us choose to be well. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.
For more information about Grace, visit our website at grace360.org.